Shrink Wrap Radio number 20, January 1st, 2006, Dr. Maria Hess on Teaching Psychology with Passion. Hello, Psychonauts. This is David Van Nuys, a.k.a. Dr. Dave, coming to you once again from the beautiful wine country in Sonoma County, California. I'm sure you know by now our show revolves around interesting personalities in and around the world of psychology. Shrink Wrap Radio is the podcast that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. It's all the psychology you need to know and just enough to make you a little bit dangerous. My guest today is Dr. Maria Hess, a longtime friend and colleague who recently won the annual Teaching Excellence Award at Sonoma State University. When she first started teaching many years ago, she apprenticed herself to me for several semesters, co-teaching a course in Introduction to Counseling. Perhaps I can claim a tiny bit of credit for the fine teacher she has become, but I have to say she brought some extraordinary talent with her from the get-go. She brings tremendous energy, intensity, and challenge to the classroom, and of course the students respond in kind. Let's get right into the interview. Okay, Maria Hess, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David.
I am so glad to have you here. You and I have known each other for years and years. We've taught together. We have a wonderful history together. And I know you as a teacher and as a psychotherapist. And I understand you're going to be giving a presentation at an upcoming psychology conference. And your topic is Teaching Psychology with Passion. What does that mean, teaching psychology with passion? Are we talking about enthusiasm or something beyond that?
Well, yeah, you know, David, it's enthusiasm and something beyond that. It's an aspect of really coming in from the teacher and the student and engaging in some sort of a genuine encounter, being two human beings and engaged in a curious process and wanting to see where it goes.
Okay. So, and you do have this presentation that's coming up.
I think
it's at the Western Psychological Association. Do you know yet sort of what some of the highlights of that presentation are going to be? What are some of the main points you plan to hit?
Yeah, well, it's for the Term and Teaching Conference, which precedes the Western Psychological Association.
Okay.
And what I'm really hoping to do here is to basically inspire teachers. And the main points are to really encourage and kind of support teachers to really be their genuine, authentic self, to kind of pop out of a role and come more fully into the encounter, the immediate encounter with the student, and then teach from that place.
Yeah, well, that's a great thing to do, and I think sometimes it's a hard thing to do, even in this role of interviewer for this podcast. I sometimes feel like my professional training gets in the way,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
Teacher, therapist, blah, 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 and that stuff can get in the way of one's own real spontaneity coming through. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, it's like we've talked before. I really think that the type of teaching that I'm talking about is where the teacher kind of first gets out of their own way, and then allows themselves to kind of engage in the environment and the immediate time of the need of the student. So every class is going to need a different thing, even if I'm teaching the same class. So it's kind of like how to set up a learning environment, how to stimulate a thinking process, an engaging process, a sort of commitment to either the material or to the relationships themselves or to a process that we're all learning together, and then basically kind of step aside. As you said before to me, it's like stirring the pot and then moving aside and kind of facilitating the way that pot moves around,
yeah.
goes deeper, or bubbles up to the top, however that goes.
Well, what's one of the classes that you teach where maybe you could give us an example of how you do that?
Well, I think Intro to Counseling is a good example,
okay.
where I set the arena by developing a syllabus and making ground rules and working with students to explore what kind of ground rules make them feel comfortable about sharing their questions and feeling vulnerable, learning something that might be really important to them, especially in Intro to Counseling. So many people come in hoping to be therapists someday.
Right.
So really to just kind of set that environment and encourage them to come forward and speak from what's important to them. And kind of role modeling, if you will, making that be safe and okay for them so that they can really explore on a level that's important to them. And I just kind of offer theory, show examples, participate with them in role plays, and then see what they come up with.
But you do role plays of therapy sessions there.
We do.
And do they do therapy with one another as part of that, or...?
They do counseling more, counseling, problem solving, goal setting, exploring like a particular niggle, if you will, that's, you know, immediate for them.
Okay.
Yeah, practice, you know, listening and paraphrasing, exchanging ideas.
Okay. Now, I was intrigued by your doctoral dissertation. I remember when you were working on that and when you finished it up. And I think the title was something like Healing in the Classroom. Mm-hmm. Do I have that right?
It was on the student's experience of healing in relationship with a teacher.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Uh-huh. Well, the way I think about this is that my own undergraduate experience, I had experiences with teachers in the classroom where my life changed, where I felt like there was a part of me that literally changed from somebody seeing me, engaging me, seeing my potential in a way that I couldn't see myself in my 20s, right?
Yeah, that's great. And I'm not sure every student gets that.
That's really true.
So you were lucky.
I was lucky.
Yeah.
I felt really lucky. And from having my own experience, I kind of had an imprint of what that was like, of feeling inspired in that way and engaged in that way. And then over years, I heard it back from students as well. You know, gosh, I had a healing experience, or I felt like my life changed as a result of being in your class, or I had therapy for 16 weeks, right?
Yeah.
And so I got real curious about, well, what happened? How did that happen? Not that it happened, but how does it happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so that got me into really looking at, well, how does it happen? What are the constituents? What makes something feel so important in a classroom, in an academic setting, that a student actually feels like their life has changed? So what I saw through written and verbal narratives with people who really self-identified as having a healing experience with teachers is that there were certain constituents, conditions for this to happen. 100% said that the genuine encounter with the teacher was the number one thing. Having an authentic role model and guide in the classroom for how to become a person fearlessly, taking risks to say things out of the box, being vulnerable about something that they grew from that was maybe a less than noble aspect of the teacher's self, you know, really coming into a human condition that somehow allowed the student to see themselves as a growing person themselves.
So it sounds like the teacher's self-disclosure was one important ingredient.
Self-disclosure,
right?
Yes. And the way that my co-researchers in the dissertation talked about it was that they really felt like there was some sort of an energetic connection also, where they felt like they were in a groove with the teacher, or in a groove with the material, or in the groove with the class, like some sort of a joined engagement was really acknowledged over and over and over again. And then students feeling so inspired that having that experience themselves, they were also then moved to reciprocate, give it to other people, wanting to engage with other people that way to improve not only the quality of their life, but others too. It was very exciting, that part.
Wow. So maybe there's a psychology teacher listening, or somebody who plans to be a psychology professor down the line would be surprised. What would be your advice to them about how they would get to that place where they could be so in sync and in the groove mm-hmm. with their students?
Well, you know, I don't know how it happens for other people until I hear back from others, but I can speak for myself, is that what I really think it is, a part of what happens here is, as I get more comfortable with my own humanity and deepen my own awareness, my own internal life, my own connection with others, whatever is important to myself that I keep alive and what has meaning for me, mm-hmm. then that becomes like the prereq, if you will, for how I then walk into the classroom. Because I just feel more available to the student. I'm not so in a position, if mm-hmm. you will. Mm-hmm. I'm more just kind of there with them. So I guess it would be like trusting love, how to love myself and love other people, love what I teach, and maybe also really believe that part where there are no accidents and things, magic can happen in the
right,
classroom.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Now, love is an interesting word to use mm-hmm. in connection with teaching.
And, it is.
And loving your students.
Truly.
And not in the way of seduction, which
right.
can be destructive, mm-hmm. but in some other way. Can you talk to us a little bit about that other way?
Well, the love that I'm talking about here has been talked about in a lot of ways. And I don't mean this, I mean this more in a spiritual, non-religious sense of the word agape love, like the ability to love all things, or to see love as a possibility in all things. Or that love has different aspects of itself. Angie Arian talks about having many faces of love, like appreciation, kindness, being willing to put your position aside in order to have the relationship, to make that choice to come out of that position of I and move toward, well, a we-ness.
Right.
And I think that that really is what I'm talking about in a bigger scope. And then loving the topic, mm-hmm. you know, the subject that you teach, to really want to make it come alive and have you understand it in a joined way so that you and I can both go, ooh, isn't that a cool
yeah.
thing to learn?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I also want to say, like, Bell Hooks, in her book, Teaching to Transgress, she wrote this amazing comment that I think I've really seen, is that teachers who love students and students who love them are held suspect in the academy. And I thought that that was a very interesting comment, that somehow if the teacher is loving, or the students love their teacher or love their classes, that somehow they're not learning, or they're not doing it right. They should have rigor and
right.
be miserable, I think.
Right, and the professor is often suspected of pandering to the students.
Right, or being a fluff teacher.
Right,
yeah, totally.
Right. Yeah, that's way too bad.
It is.
I'm really resonating to everything that you're saying here. I forgot some of the things that I really was kind of vibrating and wanting to pile in on that, because I really understand what you're saying. And I think I should share with the audience that there's substance to what you're saying, backed up by the fact that you won the university's Excellence in Teaching Award.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not just self-inflation talking here. You've really got some evidence for your effectiveness as a teacher, and I've had a chance to see that too. And I really resonate to the idea of at least some classes being able to be therapeutic.
Very much so.
In the process. I had that experience this past term, where I taught a course in Myth, Dream, and Symbol. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the term, students said, gee, I feel like I just went through 15 weeks of therapy. I didn't know I was getting into that.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's about, I'm able to step aside in that class. I set up small groups that operate fairly independently. I step in from time to time. I rotate through the groups. But it's like I set up a situation where I know certain good things can happen.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. Absolutely, David. I totally resonate. I think that's exactly the role, is that the type of teach, even if it's a, I think the most important part of what you said there were two things. One, that you had the willingness, again, to step aside. And that, two, you took the responsibility to set the environment and then keep it happening, to really be in your integrity and to watch what worked and to kind of help support what did and then maybe redirect something that didn't. And I think that's really where the action is.
Yeah, yeah.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
And I just got in touch with that other thing that I lost touch with that I wanted to share. When you were talking about love and nurturance and kind of embracing the students, I realized that I have a similar feeling about this podcast. I'm talking to people that I don't know, that I haven't met, but I have a loving, nurturing feeling about it.
You bet.
That I sort of want to be able to feed people out there with support, good information, new perspectives.
You bet. Well, that's why it's so easy to say yes when you say, you want to come on down. That's right. For that very thing. It really comes across in what you do.
Yeah. Now, you're a therapist and you're a teacher. Mm-hmm. And how do those two inform each other?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, actually, that's really what's got my attention these days, is that I'm seeing some real similarities between being a humanistic educator, a holistic person, a teacher who really teaches to the whole person, the body, the mind, the heart, the spirit, and a therapist who sees the world the same way, body, mind, heart, spirit, mm-hmm. and really noticing that, you know, there are some similarities. Like, for one, being well-educated and prepared myself and then willing to step aside. Two, another way of looking at it might be being present for the genuine encounter to see what happens in the therapeutic hour is equally, I think, as important as watching a group do it. You know, it's like, wow, what is the genuine encounter going to be with these 50 people? And how very similar that is to every client that comes in. What's the encounter going to be like for this person with themselves, with me, with myself, all of those things? I think there's a lot of similarities, really.
The two phrases that you use that stand out for me are being present and genuine encounter.
Yes. Right.
Can you say a little bit more about
Well, you know,
those?
And those are the two places I think that are, to try and quantify it does get kind of hard. It gets hard for me. Like, okay, what do I mean when I mean presence? Because for me, and I think for many people, it's a particular type of quality that I'm responding to that is different in different people. I mean, the genuine encounter with one person may be aggressive or uncomfortable, but nonetheless, when I'm with myself, there might be something there for me to learn about myself that then mm-hmm. improves the quality of my life or changes the way that I might deal with you or another person the next day. Mm-hmm. It was a genuine encounter, didn't feel great.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think sometimes people think genuine encounter, love in the classroom, all the stuff means that everything's happy, we're all smiling, we're all having a really good time. And I don't necessarily mean that. For me, what I'm really talking about in the genuine encounters where the person comes to a place in themselves where they have bumped into a truth that's really a piece that may have been instrumental for them in growing and actualizing or potentializing.
I've been with you in the classroom, and I know that you can be confrontive at times.
Yes, that's true.
And I know, I think both therapy and the classroom demand a combination of a willingness to be confronted and yet somehow communicating an underlying support at the same time. And that's a real delicate kind of razor's edge.
Mm-hmm. It sure is. And that is my growing edge always.
Yeah.
Very much so. It's how to be kind and in the moment and yet really have that kind of fearlessness that can be helpful for someone else to wiggle against mm-hmm. or even for me to wiggle mm-hmm. against.
Mm-hmm. I've received some emails from listeners, and so as a result of that, I know that a certain number of them are students that are listening to the show.
Yeah.
And I've heard from two or three who are really dissatisfied with the narrow approach to psychology that happens to be taught at whatever school they're going to. Mm-hmm. And what they hear from their professors are that if they go to a non-traditional psychology school, such as the one where you and I have taught at Sonoma State University, that they won't be able to get jobs. What do you tell your students about that? Or, you know, they're talking about going on to grad schools. I guess that's what I'm meaning when I say non-traditional. I'm thinking of those non-traditional, freestanding graduate programs in psychology.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I laugh often about this because, you know, it's now almost been 30 years that people have been telling me that. And they've been telling me the same thing. You know, they're still telling me, and now, you know.
Yeah, when you were a student, because you went a very non-traditional
route. Very non-traditional. Well, I started very traditional with the, I was a rat lab runner at Chico State, and, you know, really, that was what psychology was at the time, and somebody then mentioned, oh, by the way, did you know there's this marriage family counseling thing, and then I got really interested, but so I did have that traditional background, but my master's training and my PhD training were very non-traditional. And, you know, it's been a mixed bag because I think the part that's been the hardest, really, was in trying not to develop a defensive attitude and having to show people that they were wrong. That, you know, I didn't have to become the banner girl for all non-traditional alternative education.
Yeah, right.
And that I tell my students often, you know, here's my experience, is that I knew for me I was never going to be happy working in this traditional, very linear way of studying psychology, because it's not what spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I would be dead in the water in a very short period of time as a teacher, because there was nothing that could spur me in the same way. So for me to be able to talk about spirit along with psychopathology and to teach people to be therapists along with being whole individuals was really kind of a no-brainer for me. And so I felt like I had no choice but the alternative route.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what's been true for me also is that I think it's who I am that has given me the jobs that I wanted, that helped me pursue my career as a counselor and as a teacher and as a woman in the world, to just kind of go back to that faith of, well, I'm doing the best I can in that moment and always moving forward from that place. So that's what I tell my students is, you know, hey, follow your heart and keep your eyes open. You know, be informed, see what's out there, talk to everybody that you can talk to, find the conflicting ideas of, you know, not only psychology but other aspects of life, and then see what resonates with you.
Mm-hmm. I know you've taught this is kind of related to what you're saying. I know you've taught a course on right livelihood, which
yeah.
I believe is a Buddhist ideal about finding work that's fulfilling and does no harm.
Right.
So what's your advice to listeners who are seeking to develop their own right livelihood?
Yeah. Well, I think I would go back to that comment of, you know, follow your heart and keep your eyes open.
Okay.
Really, that to me really does kind of sum it up.
It's, again, it's walking a fine balance, the razor's edge of follow your heart, but keep your eye out to reality, too.
You bet.
Yeah.
That's right.
So how did you... I'm always interested in how people get into psychology in the first place and what it is that calls to them, where it mm-hmm. connects to their heart or their head or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find your way into psychology?
Yeah, this was such a great thing to think about. I really had to go back and think about this. And, you know, I think for me, I got into psychology without even knowing that that's what it was. I came from an incredibly scary and really violent, ignorant kind of family. And at the time, I was like 14, 15, the Vietnam vets were starting to come back and they were addicted to this drug and that drug. And there was a whole movement in Southern California where I lived for the open-door drug clinics that were there for Vietnam vets. And they did support groups for, these were some of the first support groups around people who were coming that were addicted.
Yes.
Well, and it was also pre-child protective services and pre all the services that we have now for people to talk to when there was stress. And that was the only avenue that I had as a 14 or 15-year-old girl to find somebody that could talk to me about my experience in my family. And they were so helpful to me that at one point I remember I just said to a counselor, how do you do what you do? This is a really nice thing you're doing.
Yeah.
She said, study psychology. And so I thought, what's psychology? And so I kind of just kept my mind open about that. There were a lot of books that were coming out at the time that were self-help and psychology-oriented.
Right.
And I think I moved into that exploration through literature and music first, and then in school later on.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. I know you mentioned literature, and I was, I initially majored in creative writing, and I was reading lots of fiction. And for me, somehow there's a relationship there between that interest in fiction. I guess it was about studying people's lives and mm-hmm. being really self-reflective about my own life and what it is to be alive, and so the transition from that into therapy, it's not a big gap.
It really isn't. I mean, when I think about the literature that's really engaged me, it really is that it's an extension, some of that genuine encounter, that somehow that person who's written that book has brought out whatever that juice was of the learning experience, that the story has has created around it kind of grabs at that piece of me that makes me curious about, well, how'd they do it and what ended up happening and, you know, how did they grow and could that work for me too?
Yeah, and that reminds me that you're also interested in film, and I know that you use film. You teach a class on abnormal psychology.
Uh-huh.
And say a little bit about your use of film in there.
Well, in the class, the character in the film becomes the client that we're studying for that particular diagnostic category. So the students then watch the film with that idea in mind that this person who is their client comes to them, and we're looking at their symptoms and the difficulties in living and then how we might assess them to help treat them or help them help themselves in some way.
That seems like a really creative idea. But what's an example of one of the films where you do that?
Let's see. I guess one of the most obvious is Fatal Attraction, where Glenn Close becomes the client, and we watch her go through her gyrations with Michael Douglas and try to make guesses about what was going on with her.
Boy, I don't know if I want her walking through my through my therapy door.
That's right. And most of the students feel that way, too.
Yeah. So I can see that that would be a technique that would really engage the students' interest.
It does.
Yeah,
it seems so.
Yeah. So you've kind of alluded to your non-traditional educational path. Maybe you could just quickly take us through it.
You mean like literally where did I go and what did I do?
Yeah.
Well, I did my undergraduate work, like I said, at a more experimental psych program at Chico State. And I also got my studies there were also in social welfare and corrections, because at the time I thought I might want to work in the juvenile system.
And since we may have listeners outside of this country, Chico State is part of the California State University system.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then I went to a school that is no longer in existence. It was called the Sonoma Institute, and it was a satellite institute that I actually was kind of umbrellaed under Sonoma State external degree at the time. And then I went on to the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco and got my PhD in East-West psychology.
Okay. Are there ways in which your exposure to psychology has helped you in your personal life?
And
can I press you for an example? You know, we're very voyeuristic in this field.
Yes, really, it's the best part. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was thinking about how do I answer this question? Because, melodrama aside, I really can't help but feel that for me, psychology, and particularly counseling psychology, really changed the course of my life. That had I not had intervention with the mental health system, not as a client, but as a staff person working in mental health facilities and seeing how the quality of life was really hampered by an unexamined life or by resentment and anger and bitterness that can happen from just day-to-day life, I realized that I had to kind of save my own life. And I think that in a lot of ways, counseling and psychology did that for me. It helped me save the quality of my life. I really think that it would have been very easy for me to have been in trouble, to be drug or alcohol addicted, or some way to manage some of the grief and pain in my life, had I not had the opportunity to really come into my own healing and to my own personal growth.
And part of, if I hear you right, part of what stimulated that was a kind of vicarious learning experience of seeing the problems other people were creating for themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, starting quite young. I mean, in these open door groups, you know, and open clinics, and then as a young person in psychology, as an undergraduate, and traveling through the world, I really kept just seeing the relevance of psychology and the unconscious and the inner life and dreams that just kept playing over and over and over again. My study of shamanism and other aspects of life, it just all connected back to the psyche and the soul and the self and the spirit. And I just kept following that path. It kept speaking to me as true.
Yeah. You've touched on some areas that clearly I'm going to have to interview you again after some passage of time and find out about the shamanism. And there are other interesting things you're involved in that I happen to be privy to. that I really look forward to interviewing you on in the future.
Great.
As you stand back and look at the field of psychology, do you have any ideas about where psychology needs to go?
Well, you know, I don't know that I have an opinion about where it needs to go. I know I'm really curious about where it will go and is going. I think what really seems pressing to me these days when I look at the field is that finding a way, I guess transpersonal psychology really resonates with me right now, finding a way to bridge past the individual, integrating the individual into the community, and finding ways for us to become more connected. And instead of focusing so much on our differences and our individualities, but then coming back to full circle again and again and again, right? Of how we work in communities, how we negotiate, how we live together with sustainability when resources and attitudes can become really tight with the environment and the politics.
Okay. Well, we've come to just about to the end of our time here, and I wonder if, as your farewell, if there's some favorite book within the field that's meant a lot to you that you'd want to recommend to listeners.
Sure. There's a couple. There's Alice Miller's Drama of the Gifted Child.
Oh, yes.
And the other is, it's going to date me, but it really is a great book. It's called If the Buddha, If You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him by Sheldon Kopp.
Right.
That was really an instrumental book for me. So I would say that was one I would go back to.
Both wonderful recommendations. Maria, thanks so much for being on the show. And as I say, I'm definitely going to have you back.
Thanks, David.
That's our interview for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Let's reach down into the mailbag, and we've got a piece of listener mail that seems to be very apt. It's from Russell P., and he says, "Hello. I wanted to send you a quick email thanking you for your podcast. I cannot comment as to the entirety of your work, as I'm still working my way through your early episodes. However, what I have experienced so far has been enjoyable and a good companion on my morning walks." Hey, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. "My experience is much like that of your listener in episode number 9. I am an undergraduate psychology student at a state university in California, and I find that the presentation of psychology at my university is overwhelmingly from a social learning perspective. I have not, as of yet, formed an allegiance to any one point of view or subspecialty in psychology, nor do I feel a desire to. However, my professors indicate to me that in order to attend graduate school, I do need to have a narrowing of focus. Narrowing focus in psychology seems to me to be a sure way to get lost in the trees and lose any chance of gaining an understanding of the forest of the human psyche. While I understand that there are a number of programs like the Depth Psychology Program at Sonoma which might appeal to me, I have been told that such programs are not preparatory for my eventual career goal, gaining a doctorate and teaching psychology at the university level. I was wondering whether you had any advice for somebody in my situation and whether you could confirm or deny my professor's view of the field." Russell, thanks very much for this email query. Unfortunately, I probably have to confirm what your professors have been telling you to some degree. Now, you've just heard my guest, Maria Hess, who did follow a very non-traditional path, and she has ended up in a state university. However, she would probably be quick to tell you that it wasn't necessarily an easy way to go. One possibility is that you could get a master's degree in a field like depth psychology, and then from there get into a PhD program that is more traditional, so that you get your, quotes, union card. The other possibility is you pay your dues in a traditional PhD program, but your education doesn't stop there. Once you've got that union card, you can follow your nose and go any direction that you wish. Russell, I wish I could give you some really definitive advice. I really respect and admire your desire to not foreclose too quickly on any particular psychological theory. One of the reasons I chose to go into psychology is that it offered so many different career paths from which to choose. But at the same time, at some point, we have to make a choice to follow some path if there's to be any forward movement. Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss. Carlos Castaneda says, follow the path with heart. Your professors say, take the safe path. I can tell you that over the years, I've seen some students who followed their bliss pioneer amazing careers for themselves. At the same time, others fell by the wayside. When it comes down to it, I think it depends a lot on your own talent, conviction, determination, courage, and self-confidence. And that's something that only you can know. Well, my friends, that's this week's show. Please help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio. Also, iTunes has just created an opportunity for listeners to write short reviews of their favorite shows. If you like what you're hearing here, we'd sure appreciate your endorsement on iTunes. Just go to the podcast area of the music store and type Shrink Wrap Radio into the search box. When the page comes up, you'll see a link near the top of the page to leave a review. Also, please send email. What kinds of psychology would you like to hear more about? Do you have other suggestions? Your feedback keeps us going. Send your emails or MP3 audio comments to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave your voicemail for us on Skype or Gizmo Project. Our name on both is ShrinkPod. You'll find our show notes along with suggested readings at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. And finally, you might want to stick around after our closing theme music for our latest PodSafe musical selection. So, once again, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.